Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, our source material is Pastor Kent Wagner's latest message, and our mission here is to get you completely prepped and, you know, primed for your Connect groups this week.
Yeah, we're really going to get into the theology, the history, and kind of the psychology behind what he preached.
Exactly. But, I mean, before we get to any of the deep stuff, we have to talk about the visual. Our pastor standing waist-deep in the baptismal water, completely soaked in his Sunday clothes.
Oh, man, with his asthma inhaler still in his pocket.
Yes. The inhaler surviving the plunge. I mean, he left his phone on the steps, which was smart, but that moment just it completely broke the predictable rhythm we're so used to on a Sunday morning at Harmony Christian.
Right, because we all expect the normal flow, you know, the worship songs, the polite lobby chatter, the structured message.
Yeah, the routine.
Exactly. So seeing someone just step into a pool wearing a dress shirt and slacks was, I mean, it was profoundly disruptive.
It really was. And that disruption is exactly what we need to unpack today, because it wasn't a stunt. It was really the physical climax of this massive life-altering concept that Kent called margin.
Yeah, and he started this entire conversation by doing something that leaders, especially pastors, honestly rarely do.
Oh, for sure. He completely shattered the illusion that he has his life perfectly managed.
Right. He took us back to this deeply personal crisis involving a rental cabin he and his wife were building at the Red River Gorge.
Which, you know, he provided some crucial context there, so we really understood the weight of it.
Yeah, because this was not some frivolous, impulsive purchase.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had saved for years. He ran all the complex math, planned the construction timeline, mapped out exactly what it would take to get this cabin generating income.
He did everything by the book.
Exactly. He operated entirely by the book.
The problem with the book, though, is that reality rarely actually roots it.
Right. That's so true.
Yeah, so the project started dragging, their savings depleted way faster than expected, and he hit this wall where he's just staring at a half-finished cabin that's basically acting like a vacuum on his bank account.
Just sucking all the funds dry.
Totally. And realizing they might not actually be able to finish the build, he described this recurring nightmare. He called it his cliff dream.
Right, which is a feeling that resonates with, I mean, almost anyone who has ever faced a financial crisis.
Oh, absolutely.
Because his cliff dream didn't involve a literal mountain. It was this midnight panic where he envisioned himself bankrupt, divorced, estranged from his kids, and literally living out of his 2011 Dodge Ram.
Just laying there at 3 a.m, staring at the ceiling, calculating his own ruin. It's so relatable.
It really is.
And he told us about getting off this gut-wrenching phone call with his lawyer where just nothing was resolved. His stomach is in knots. And the very next thing he sees on his phone is a missed call from David Birchfield.
Our executive pastor.
Right.
The guy responsible for the operational reality of Harmony Christian. I mean, he keeps the lights on, the staff paid.
So Kent does what any of us do when we're falling apart, but we have to work, you know? He puts on his fake, happy, professional voice and calls David back.
Yeah, the everything is fine voice.
Exactly. And then David drops a literal nuclear bomb. Providence Christian Academy, PCA, which rented a massive portion of our building, was closing its doors permanently.
Wow.
Yeah. They had 2.5 months to figure out a completely new financial reality.
Which, I mean, the math on that closure was staggering. PCA's departure meant an immediate $20,000 a month deficit for the church.
Just brutal.
Yeah. And you really have to consider the emotional whiplash of that number.
Mm-hmm.
Because God had just brought this congregation back from a low of, what, 200 people during COVID?
Yeah, to around 600.
Right. So just as the church is finally catching its breath, the oxygen is sucked right out of the room again.
Thinking about this whole timeline, like the personal financial panic crashing directly into the church's financial panic, a mechanical analogy came to mind.
Oh, really? What's that?
Losing your margin in life is exactly like driving a car that has had its shock absorbers completely removed.
Oh, that's good. Like the struts and springs that absorb all the kinetic energy of the road.
Yes, exactly. When your car has healthy shock absorbers, you can hit a pothole, which, you know, in life might be a bad day at the office or an unexpected medical bill, maybe a flat tire.
Right, like, minor inconveniences.
Yeah, and the car just absorbs the energy. You feel a bump, maybe your coffee rattles a bit, but you just keep driving.
Right.
But when your margin is gone, when those shock absorbers are just completely shot, every tiny pebble on the asphalt translates into this spine-shattering collision.
Because you have zero buffer left to absorb the impact of just being human.
Exactly. And Kent posed a very uncomfortable question based on this. And if you're listening right now, I really want you to ask yourself this before your Connect group. When your margin is squeezed down to absolutely nothing, who actually suffers?
Man, the painful truth is that the answer is rarely just confined to ourselves.
Right.
The blast radius always catches the people closest to us.
Right.
And Kent was incredibly transparent about the fact that his wife suffered, his kids suffered, our elders suffered.
Yeah, he recounted being in those high-level leadership meetings and just snapping at people.
Having to circle back 15 minutes later to apologize because the tension was just leaking out of him in real time.
We have all been there. But instead of just saying, you know, try harder to be nice, Kent introduced this really fascinating concept to explain why we snap when those shock absorbers are gone.
Right, the pilot instrument testing analogy.
Yes.
Spatial disorientation.
Yeah.
It is honestly one of the most studied and dangerous phenomena in aviation psychology.
Okay, wait. Because he mentioned that a pilot's inner ear literally lies to them in a storm. How does that actually work mechanically? Because I was a little lost on how your own body tricks you into crashing.
Yeah, so it comes down to the vestibular system in your inner ear. It's filled with fluid and these tiny little hairs that sense movement.
Okay.
When you enter a sustained banking turn in an aircraft, the fluid eventually catches up to the motion of the plane and just settles down.
Oh, I see.
So your brain interprets the stillness as flying straight and level, even though you're actually turning sharply.
Wow.
Right. And if the pilot then corrects the plane and actually flies straight, the fluid sloshes in the opposite direction.
Mm.
So the pilot's brain starts screaming that they're suddenly spinning out of control.
So they feel like they're falling. They pull up based on their gut instinct, but they're actually driving the nose of the plane straight into the ground.
Precisely. Which is why they're so rigorously tested to fly using only their dashboard instruments.
They have to trust the gauges.
Yeah, they have to actively ignore their screaming physiological instincts and trust the artificial horizon gauge to tell them which way is true north and which way is actually up.
That is wild. And bringing this back to our lives, Kent argued that when a crisis hits and our margin evaporates, we suffer that same spatial disorientation.
Exactly.
I mean, the actual objective reality of his life hadn't changed in the 10 seconds between checking his voicemail and hearing the news from David, but his internal world just started spinning.
Right. When we lose our bearings, we lose sight of our purpose.
Yeah.
That causality is really the core of his argument. Losing your bearings destroys your sense of purpose. And when you lack purpose, you have no filter to set your priorities.
Which leads right to Kent's conclusion.
Yep. When you cannot set your priorities, your day plans you. Instead of you planning your day.
You just become this reactionary mechanism, right? Just answering whoever is screaming the loudest.
Exactly.
I do want to push back on one assumption we often make here, though.
Okay, go for it.
When we talk about losing our bearings or, you know, a storm hitting, we automatically assume it's a tragedy. Like cancer, bankruptcy, a divorce.
Right, the bad stuff.
Yeah. But Kent dropped that detail about a businessman in our church whose business was booming. It was so wildly successful, he literally didn't have time to breathe.
That's a great point.
Sometimes the storm that strips away your margin isn't a tragedy at all. Sometimes it is overwhelming success and simply having too much good in your life.
Oh, absolutely. An overflowing calendar of purely positive things. You know, promotions, travel sports for the kids, social obligations, community leadership. It will strip your margin with the exact same ruthless efficiency as a calendar packed with medical emergencies.
Because the psychological result is identical.
Exactly. The day plans you and your shock absorbers fail.
And when those shock absorbers fail, we all develop coping mechanisms. Kent referred to himself as an escape artist.
Yes, I love that phrase.
Right. When the pressure mounts, he runs to Oreos, bowls of ice cream, or doing what he called productive but meaningless tasks.
Which is so common.
I have to admit, that last one felt like a personal attack. I will reorganize an entire closet just to avoid dealing with a looming deadline.
Well, you're engaging in the illusion of control there.
Ouch, but true.
I mean, reorganizing a closet or cleaning out the garage does absolutely nothing to solve a $20,000 a month organizational deficit.
Right, obviously.
But the tactile sensation of putting things in boxes, it lowers your cortisol levels temporarily because it makes you feel like you have mastery over your environment.
Yeah, it's totally an illusion. And Kent challenged all of us to identify our own godless habits.
Which he clarified, right?
Yeah, he clarified that godless doesn't mean you're out committing crimes. It just means a habit that operates completely independent of God.
Right.
So, If you're listening on your commute or at the gym right now, what is your godless habit when your schedule blows up? Do you try to micromanage your spouse? Do you completely check out and just scroll through your phone while your kids are trying to tell you about their day?
Yeah, we all have something. And to find a better alternative to these escape mechanisms, Kent pointed us toward the historical model of Jesus.
Specifically, he anchored us in the first chapter of the Gospel of Mark in this bustling town of Capernaum.
Right.
And the sheer chaos of this biblical narrative is wild. Jesus is preaching in the synagogue, and Crazy Harry, this demon-possessed man, just starts screaming in the middle of the service.
Talk about losing control of the room.
Seriously. So Jesus casts the demon out, diffuses the situation, leaves the synagogue, and immediately goes to Simon Peter's house. And there, he finds Peter's mother-in-law suffering from a severe fever.
So he has to heal her, too.
Right. He's already had this highly demanding, emotionally draining day. But then the sun finally goes down.
And the sunset is the absolute hinge upon which this entire story turns.
Yeah, break that down for us. Because without understanding the first century cultural context of the sunset, the sudden surge of the crowd makes no logical sense.
Right, because the day this all occurred was the Sabbath.
So what did those Sabbath rules actually look like? We don't really have a modern equivalent to how strict this was.
No, we don't. Under the Jewish law of that era, the Sabbath lasted from sundown on Friday until sundown on Saturday. And during this 24-hour period, observant Jews were bound by strict prohibitions against work.
Okay.
In the oral traditions that were later codified in the Mishnah, this included restrictions on carrying any kind of burden, like carrying a sick person on a mat, and strict limits on how far a person could even travel from their home.
Wow. So you have a town of about 1,500 people. The rumor mill is running at absolute maximum capacity all day long about this guy who healed Crazy Harry.
Oh, the gossip must have been insane.
But everyone is trapped in their houses. They are literally sitting in their living rooms, staring out their windows, just watching the sun slowly inch its way toward the horizon.
The psychological tension building across Capernaum for those 8 hours would have been immense.
I can't even imagine.
And the absolute second that sun dipped below the horizon, the Sabbath legally ended. The floodgates opened. Every single sick, injured, and demon-possessed person in the entire region was simultaneously carried to Simon Peter's front door.
It's just crazy. Kent painted this picture of Jesus, right? He's a carpenter by trade.
Yeah.
A guy used to working relatively quietly, maybe dealing with one annoying homeowner watching him fix a roof.
Right, right.
And suddenly he walks out the front door and faces the biggest Woodstock or Coachella crowd of the ancient world.
Yeah, they're all just clamoring for a piece of his time, his energy, his power.
And he stays out there healing people deep into the dark hours of the night.
Which, I mean, that level of output leads directly to a phenomenon Kent and his friend Josh termed the holy hangover.
It is such a brilliant description.
It really is.
That bone-deep physical, mental, and spiritual exhaustion that just washes over you when you have poured absolutely every ounce of yourself out for the benefit of other people.
Jesus had to have woken up feeling that exact drain. He gave everything.
But what he does the next morning is where the model really challenges our modern sensibilities.
Right. Just consider what an influencer or a leader today would do after achieving that level of viral, undeniable success.
Oh, you capitalize on it immediately.
Exactly.
You launch the Instagram account, you start selling merchandise, you book a stadium tour, you lean into the momentum because the crowd finally loves you.
But Jesus takes the exact opposite approach. While it is still completely dark outside, despite his physical exhaustion from the night before, he gets up, leaves the house, and walks away from the town to find a solitary place to pray.
He intentionally removed himself from the chaos to recenter himself in the reality of God.
Yes.
Kent repeated that phrase so many times. Recenter yourself in reality. The reality being that the demands of the crowd do not dictate your existence.
And look at how his closest followers reacted to this. Simon Peter and the other disciples track him down in the dark.
Yeah, they're probably freaking out.
Oh, their dialogue is totally filled with panic and excitement. They tell him, everyone is looking for you.
They assume this is it, the inflection point where their ministry takes over the whole region.
Exactly. And Jesus shuts it down.
He shuts it down.
He tells them, let us go somewhere else to the nearby villages so I can preach there also.
Yeah.
That is why I have come.
He literally packs up and walks away from a crowd that is begging for his attention.
Because he possessed everything. Absolute clarity regarding his purpose.
Yeah.
He knew his ultimate mission was to preach the kingdom of God across the region. He refused to let the immediate demands of a very loud crowd hijack that broader purpose.
It's so countercultural.
It is. He demonstrated that sometimes you have to say no to a genuinely good thing, like healing the remaining sick people in Capernaum, in order to say yes to the ultimate thing you were meant to do.
So how do we get that kind of clarity when our own lives are screaming at us?
Right, that's the big question.
And Kent gave us a visual for this that I think is really going to dominate Connect group conversations this week.
Rope.
The analogy of the rope. Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine him standing on the stage holding this thick rope. That rope extends out of his hands, goes all the way across the stage, down the center aisle, out the doors of the sanctuary, and just continues on for hundreds of miles.
It keeps going.
Right. And that infinite length of rope represents eternity.
But the tiny frayed end of the rope, just the 3 or 4 inches resting inside the palm of Kent's hand, represents your current earthly life.
Yes. And the trap we fall into, the reason we lose our margin, is because we grip that tiny little end of the rope and we obsess over it as if it is the entire length of the rope.
We let the sheer volume of our current moment.
Yeah.
You know, $20,000 deficits, the demanding bosses, the desire for the cabin at the gorge, convince our brains that these few inches are all that exist.
Exactly. We fail to recenter ourselves in the reality that an entire eternity is already secured for us.
And the psychology of this is profound. If you can cognitively reframe your existence, if you truly internalize that you are inducted into the royal family of the creator of the universe, as Kent phrased it, it shifts the denominator of your problems.
That's a great way to put it.
A massive financial crisis feels insurmountable when your life is the only context.
Right.
But when you expand your timeline to eternity, the mathematical weight of that current crisis shrinks.
It really does.
I mean, it doesn't pay the bills, obviously.
Yeah.
But it completely neutralizes the panic. It loosens your grip.
And loosening that grip is exactly what led to the climax of the service.
Oh, man. What a moment.
Even though the official baptisms were rigidly scheduled for the second service, Kent just paused the entire progression of the morning.
He threw out the schedule.
He talked about how desperately we hold on to the illusion that we have our lives together, and then he just takes off his shoes and socks.
Which, removing your footwear on a stage, is such an incredibly vulnerable, almost jarring thing to witness in a formal setting.
It really is. So he empties his pockets, keeping the asthma inhaler, of course, and he steps down into the baptismal water.
Wearing his nice dress shirt, his slacks, fully clothed.
Yeah, fully clothed. And he stands there, the water soaking into his Sunday clothes. And he tells the story of the well-dressed man from a previous service.
Right. A man who felt a profound, immediate conviction to be baptized right in that moment.
But he hesitated.
Yeah, he hesitated because he didn't have a change of clothes. He was paralyzed by the thought of ruining his suit and looking undignified in front of the congregation.
But Kent told him the dignity didn't matter. He could do it exactly as he was.
Stepping into that water fully clothed is the most raw, tangible metaphor for dying to your own illusions.
Absolutely. It is standing in front of hundreds of people and visually declaring, I do not have my life together. My shock absorbers are gone. I am a mess, and I am surrendering my need for control right here.
Kent basically threw down a gauntlet.
He did. He said he would stand in that water and look like a fool all afternoon if it meant one person found the courage to claim their true purpose.
And the reaction from the congregation was not polite applause.
No, it was electric.
It really was.
People just started standing up and coming forward. No schedule, no pristine change of clothes. They were spontaneously surrendering that illusion of control, letting go of their tiny end of the rope and getting baptized right then and there.
Amazing.
And the church just erupted. Kent was entirely accurate when he said we were cheering louder than if we were at a Wildcats game watching a buzzer beater. The sheer joy and relief in that room was just palpable.
Because the congregation was watching people physically enact what it means to recenter yourself in reality.
Yes.
The act of baptism requires you to yield complete control of your body. You go under the water, and you must rely entirely on another human being to hold you and physically pull you back to the surface.
Wow.
It is the ultimate bodily expression of letting go of your own manufactured margin and trusting God to provide the stability you lack.
That is beautifully said. All right, Harmony family, if you've been tracking with us, you are officially prepped.
You ready?
You have the context behind the Capernaum crowds, the mechanics of spatial disorientation, and the profound meaning behind those wet church clothes.
You are ready to walk into your Connect groups and have incredibly rich conversations about where your shock absorbers are failing.
Exactly. And hey, as a quick practical reminder from the end of the service. Please remember to pick up your elementary kids in the designated kids area, not their classrooms.
Right.
As Pastor Kent joked, much like Jesus in the tomb, they are not there.
A very necessary logistical anchor after such a deeply spiritual morning.
For sure.
But before you head to your small groups this week, I do want to leave you with one final thought to wrestle with.
Okay, let's hear it.
Think back to the discipline Jesus showed when he walked away from Capernaum. He had to deliberately disappoint people who genuinely wanted and needed his attention, simply because he knew his overarching purpose.
So, as you look at your own calendar this week, if recentering in reality means you have to occasionally disappoint people who demand your time, what good thing in your life right now is quietly destroying your margin?
That's a tough question.
And more importantly, do you have the courage to walk away from it to protect your true purpose? Take that question with you. We will see you at Connect Group.